name is Chris Mortimer. I was born and raised in South London. I've lived here all my life. And living in London, you know, there's so many different kind of people. Basically, from every corner of the earth, you can find someone here. So I had different friends from all kind of backgrounds. And I guess that's the kind of background that I grew up in. Raised in a Catholic family, so we were quite a religious Catholic family, so we'd go to church every week, and you know, even on holidays, wherever we were, we'd always find a church to go to on a Sunday. So that was my background. I was raised until I was maybe around 15 or 16. I've got two brothers. One is 5 years older and one is two years younger. And but actually my father's family are all from Ireland, which is quite a religious country, quite a Catholic country. Traditionally, you know, it has always been more like. So I think one half of the family is very much from that background. Mother is from an English background, but again a Catholic background. She was actually raised in Uganda, which is probably more sort of strictly practicing country than maybe England is. So she was raised in a Catholic school run by nuns in Uganda. So quite a, sort of both my parents were quite strong Catholic. And I guess as a youngster, I took, you know, religion just as it was given to me, so I just accepted it. But then as I grew older, I would say that religion probably played less of an important role in my life anyway. So I wasn't really overly conscious of being, you know, a Catholic or being a Christian. I was just like, you know, like every youth was sort of fitting in and living the normal lifestyle of everyone around. So it wasn't like Christianity was like a really central part of my identity. My background is very much like an average English or British kind of person. You know, I used to, at school, you know, I used to enjoy going out with my friends, and then when I was at university, you know, going to parties. Just, this is, you know, having a lot of fun, basically, was what I was into. Alhamdulillah. Welcome in.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Okay. So one masculine word that you already know, a new feminine word.
The other document that I did is on tape upstairs, isn't it?
Deleted. Okay. If you want to write that ayah down, you can do that. Keep up to date, okay? A little bit of homework, and then we'll be able to use our new words to do interesting things with them next week. So we'll see you next week. Wassalamu alaikum.
I hope you guys enjoyed our Arabic class.
Oh my God, we're at Sunday.
2005 from my degree. 2006 when I did a master's in law, yeah. Degree from Reading and a master's from London School of Economics. So yes, Sophia, she studied pharmacy at the London School of Pharmacy, so she's a qualified pharmacist. So she'd had a, you know, similar to myself, you know, I'd been to university and studied a degree and a master's. She'd been to university, studied a degree and a master's. You know, she'd studied a master's in London, I studied a master's in London. You know, there's a much more in common between us than there was sort of difference, I guess.
My parents were born in East Africa, Tanzania. My grandparents from India. So, and then they moved here. My dad studied medicine here. So when he was in his 20s, probably. And yeah, all the kids are born here. And
the very first time I met Sophia, I was working on a different TV channel. And she was involved in arranging the filming, and I was a guest on the show. And we were talking, and she mentioned that her father was the president of Hadri Islamic Center. So what happened? As soon as she said that, I thought there's no way. I just, you know, I thought president.
And I was trying to give him a hint, saying to my dad.
She was trying to say to me, sue my father, please go and speak to my father. Whereas when I heard it, I said, oh, her father is the president of the Islamic Center. He would never accept a white guy, a convert, you know. So this is so we got our wires crossed.
Before he came, not the convert, we would have said no more white people.
Not just white. No white, no black, no Hindu, no
Kodja.
Oh,
that was
the
thing. You're very Kodja.
But then when she talked about Chris, I said, okay, we'll meet. And I met Chris just like that. And then I asked Chris, what do you think of my face? They're fine, no problem. I said, okay, no problem with you then.
Yeah, we're Muslims, but originally from India, Gujarat. So we're Gujaratis, so we speak Gujarati. One thing about us, Gujaratis, we are very adaptable. Every culture, we do take the good. We took things from Africa, we took things from England, we're still keeping our culture beside our religion, and we're proud of it.
Initially, even when we came, you sudden change from being restricted back in Africa, culturally, and come here, the independence, the nightclubs, the music, everything. Meeting boys and girls meeting each other was so easier, contact was easier. So initially, we all changed for the worse in every way. Mm-hmm. People were eating haram food, nightclubs, music. And we also, same thing was happening to our children. They were not brought up in Islamic way at all, because we, the parents, were not Islamic. So they're getting it everything. And the credit, the big credit here goes to Imam Khomeini. When the revolution came, we started changing quite a lot. We realized what we're doing is wrong. Because it was a negative publicity. TV was portraying Imam Khomeini as doing what he was doing. But it worked positively for us. And now, like I said, every center's got English, the internet, these, that, people going to Ziyarat. In fact, what's happened now, our children, most of our children, have become better Muslims than us even. They would tell us what we are doing is wrong.
Many people who I know who became, I've heard this experience quite a few times, and many of the converts in this country have been converts since the revolution in Iran, and were heavily influenced by seeing the stand that Imam Khomeini took, standing up against oppression in the world, against the capitalist and the communist side, standing up against the apartheid in South Africa. And this was a huge, he had a huge influence on many people in this country. And so many of the converts who became Muslim at that time were inspired by Imam Khomeini. And then what would happen is they would become Muslim. But the only mosques or Muslims were brothers from Ahlul Sunnah. So they would go to Ahlul Sunnah. They would go to Ahlul Sunnah mosques, and they would go there. But then they would say, my inspiration always is Imam Khomeini, and they'd be very passionate. But then people would tell them, well, brother Imam Khomeini is not strictly, it's arguable he might not be a Muslim, or this school is not really proper. It's not a proper Islamic school, and so they were. Obviously, their love for Imam Khomeini didn't stop at that point. It's just that they suddenly realised they had gone to the wrong mosque. Mm. So they would find out more. Okay, what was this school? So this is the first time they would hear that Imam Khomeini is Shia. So then rather than saying okay, I'm going to leave Imam Khomeini, he's Shia, they would say okay, great, where are the Shia? So then they would go and find out what is Shia, what does Shia believe, and this brought many into the school of Ahlul Bayt in this way. Friends at school who are of different religions, so some Muslims and Hindus and Christians, all different backgrounds. The first time I ever had a conversation about Islam was when I was 13 years old. And there's only Muslims who went to my school when I was younger. So even when I was like 15 years old, we'd go away on school trips, and I remember sharing a room with somebody who used to pray. He was a Muslim Pakistani who used to pray. And so while we went off to the bars and everything, he wouldn't go because he said, you know what, I don't go to bars, I don't drink. And this was the first, you know, this is one of the first times I really became aware that, oh, there's a difference between, you know, us and Muslims. And so even I remember growing up in school asking Muslims, you know, oh, what are you doing for Christmas? And they say, oh, we don't celebrate Christmas. And I'd say, oh, you know, how can you not celebrate Christmas? So, you know, so I think from, but I think from having that friendship, I started to understand, first of all, that there was a very different way of life to the one that I was living, because you're raised in a certain system in a certain way, and you're brought up to think that, you know, naturally you start to think that this is the only way of life, this is the only system of living. And then you come across others who take a very different view on life. When I was finding Muslims actually did things in a different way, you know. So, for example, they wouldn't eat certain foods, or they would pray at certain times. The women would dress in a certain way. I just found this interesting, that actually there's a whole different system out there. I remember I used to look at hijab as being so oppressive, and is it really necessary? You know, what's the need for this hijab and everything else? Like most Western people might think. But then when I saw, for example, one of my friends, whose mother and sister and women of the family would wear hijab, and I realised that actually, regardless of anyone else, like regardless of, you know, I had this view that, you know, Muslim men make their women wear hijab. This was my view. But then as I started to get to know the family and understand, I realised that actually, take the men out of the family, the women would wear hijab by themselves. It's their own obligation. It's their own sense of purpose. It's their own decision. And so this is when I started to say, okay, actually, there's a reason behind this. And then that made me ask, okay, why would they want to do it? And then I started to look at, you know, like the way that, for example, you know, the female's body has become something, you know, used to sell products in Western countries. You know, you hang your product off a female's body and people will go out and buy it. And, you know, and I started to realise, actually, this is exploitation more than what hijab is. And so this is when I started, I think practically, the advantage I had was that I got to see how people were, and I got to discuss with people and ask questions. Why do you do this? Why do you believe like this? Why do you do this action? So this was a really real benefit I had of having Muslim friends. Enjoy my food, and when I first became Muslim, there were so many different types of food I had to stop eating, because, for example, you couldn't find like Italian food, you couldn't find this kind of food, good burger, Chinese food, all of these kind of food was never halal in London. But now, alhamdulillah, in the last 5 years since I became Muslim, all the different types of food, so now you can get halal Chinese or halal Italian food or like this English food, so everything now which I used to enjoy, I can now have the halal version. So this is like a traditional English breakfast food, and okay, so you have eggs and beans, and this is made from potato, and this is just bread and a mushroom. But what's interesting is that these here are usually made from pork, but so this is instead they have in for the halal version, we have turkey and I think beef for the sausage or chicken. So it's a traditional English breakfast, but it's been modified to be good for Muslims to eat. So yeah, nonetheless, and it's very nice. It's as good as, yeah, it's better than the real thing.
My friend, who's the main person who introduced me to Islam, he is coming to mosque tonight. So inshallah, I can speak to him as well. Ali, yeah. He's Iraqi.
Well, we took the same train from school to home. Obviously, we met up on the trains on the way home, and we started talking a lot. And obviously, when we started talking, we really liked each other, and we kind of got on well. And we were interested in the same topics, I think. Both of us come from strong family units, I think, as well. Yeah. I think we have been brought up very similarly, I think. I think brought up with the same values.
As categorically talking about that. Now, this is a hadith from Jabir ibn Abdullah Ansari, in which he states, these are all from Sunni sources.
I always knew I was a Muslim, and I was a follower of the Ahlul Bayt from a fairly young age. Coming to this country, I never lost that at all. We became, I think, best of friends without even talking about Islam initially. Because I cared for him, I wanted the best for him, and I felt that Islam would be the best for any person. So I started talking, I brought up the subject, I told him about Islam, I started talking about
We were good friends before we ever spoke about Islam, so we were good friends first. But sometimes you get people, they want to go out and convert people to their religion. Sometimes this is like selfishly motivated, you know, like, I want to go out and I want to convert you and convert you, and I want everyone to believe, you know, I want everyone to be on the same path as me. But what I felt like genuinely with Ali was that, you know, he cared, like, we were good friends. He cared a lot for me. And he had a lot of passion for his own religion, his own belief. Like, when you have something good, you want those around you to the people you care about to have it too. Mm-hmm. And I really felt like that was definitely the experience. That's how it felt like to me.
My parents had a lot of love for Chris, and to an extent, the amount of time he slept mm-hmm. around the house, and my parents bought him a bed mm-hmm. that he slept under my bed. They bought a bed, you know, a special bed for me,
a special portable bed.
And he would come, you know. I mean, every weekend he would sleep around. Every weekend, my parents trusted Chris as a good, I think, a good influence on me, even though he was very far from being a Muslim back then. Yeah. Never imagined that 13 years later, we'd be sitting here and.
This is my local centre, which really feels like home to me. It's very comfortable. I feel very at ease here, alhamdulillah. And this actually used to be a synagogue until just over 20 years ago, I believe. It was acquired. It was acquired and converted into a mosque. And actually, still we have interfaith programs here. So we'd get like a priest and maybe a Hindu speaker and a rabbi, a Jewish rabbi would come along. And actually, the rabbi who used to be the head of this synagogue, he comes along and has actually come to a couple of these programs.
They need the classrooms, the blackboards. They teach Quran, Arabic. Arabic, like, it all starts from 4 years old. So my nephew's just joined, he's four. History. It's basically like 10 to 1:30 every Saturday morning. And you know, like, we both teach now, and then we hope, like, obviously our children will go there. And it's like, we teach for free. It's like paying back to the community. And it just keeps going. I myself have learned there, and I've gone there.
What I want to say is this word is found in Surah Yasin. That's all. Kana mawjood. Kunta mawjood.
He said you were
here. Kunta mawjood now. For a reason of a deepa. I would just love my children to speak as many languages as possible. I mean, I think Arabic is something which, you know, I have a goal to try to speak to them in Arabic when they're young, you know, just really try and focus on that so that they can just learn it innately from a young age, because they would absorb it really well at that age. I want Sophia's parents to speak to them in Gujarati. I'd like them to go to Urdu lectures so they can start picking up Urdu. English obviously is going to come, because we live in England, they're going to go to school, so English is a kind of a given that we'll learn this. But I just think the more languages the better, because, you know, otherwise you're closing the every language that you earn, you're opening up a whole new gate of interaction, of conversation, of gaining knowledge, of experience, you know. And it's something I've only really realised since I studied Arabic, that as long as I was only speaking English, I was just confined to a very limited sources of information, very limited understanding of things. As soon as I opened Arabic, a massive whole wave opened up. So inshallah, I hope that they would learn as many as possible.
half an hour to do the interview.
One interesting thing to note is that actually since 2001, since the attacks of 9/11, more people have started becoming Muslim in the West. And the reason for this is because people have become interested. So people pick up the Quran, they start to look into Islam, say, where does this terrorism come from? Where's the verses in this Quran about killing people? You know, this is what people are interested. I remember I heard after September the 11th, some of the bookstores here, they ran out of copies of the Quran because people wanted to buy it and find out what is this religion that's making people act like this. So actually, these bombings have actually had a kind of a polarizing effect. So some people have become very anti-Islam. Some people have gone to find out what is Islam and have actually ended up accepting it. So it's had effects both ways. I looked into Islam, I researched on the internet, I had friends, and we discussed Islam on and off for about 6 years. I was having these kind of conversations, and even sometimes going to the masjid, going to the mosque to see a lecture, to ask questions. And this was ongoing between the age of about 13 and 19. It was actually when I was 19, that's when I took my shahada, but it was quite a long process before that. I had all of these kind of questions about, you know, is it really necessary, you know, for example, you know, for me to stop drinking alcohol, do I really have to? Is it really necessary that, you know, I can't go to mixed gatherings and you know, party, you know, drink, you know, no, forget drinking, but just even like, you know, what's really that bad about meeting up and dancing and then mixed gathering? You know, do I really need to leave that behind? Or, you know, having mixed friendships, you know, with boys and girls, you know, was this really necessary? And music, I know even Islam, you know, has things to say against music. I was like, oh, I really need to stop listening to my favourite music. All of these kind of things were going through my mind. Until finally, I think, actually the moment when I took my shahada, I remember I was sitting in a lecture, and the scholar was talking about the jihad al-nafs. So he was talking about, you know, the battle against the self, and when you wake up, the fajr and the nafs is telling you to go to sleep, and, you know, you know you should wake up. And he was giving all different examples, and the way he was talking, you know, I just felt like, you know, he's just talking to me personally. You know, this is just written, this whole thing is just for me. And I just remember halfway through this lecture, I just thought, you know, there's no way that this was written down in the desert 1400 years ago, or, you know, made up by something. It's just impossible, because right now, today, he's speaking personally to me. And I just felt, you know, that this was, at that point, I just had to accept. I just had to say, you know, this is the time now. I remember I said to Ali, I was like, I can't take my shahada. He was like, what? It was really? Because after so many years of just talking and backwards and forward and debates, you know, just it was such a shock, because, you know, I had never said to him, you know, I'm going to go out and say my shahada, and I hadn't thought about anything like that. But it was just at that 1 minute, I just suddenly clicked and said, right, okay, this has to happen now. Mm. And so, yeah, it was just, I took my shahada that day, and alhamdulillah, nothing's been quite the same since, but in a good way, in a very good way, alhamdulillah. In the first instance, when I first told them, they were very upset, because, you know, what the media says about Islam, it portrays a very aggressive or violent or very distorted, very bad version of Islam. So they were quite worried at first, because it had been like the attacks on September 11th, and it had been all these kind of things. And my mum was very worried. My father was more, you know, how could you leave Christianity? And I remember actually my mother being very upset, and even going to my friend Ali's house and saying, you know, how could you do this? And it was very difficult at the start. And then what happened for about a year after that, we just didn't really talk about Islam. So I would go, I'd practice, I knew I was practicing as a Muslim, and I'd pray in my bedroom privately. And when we had dinner, I just wouldn't eat the meat because I knew it wasn't halal, so I just had the vegetables and potatoes. And this was the way, you know, we didn't really discuss it.
But then after about a year, it started to become a bit easier. You know, time starts to become a healer. My parents saw that I hadn't changed into some, you know, really bad person, or, you know, the worst fears hadn't come true. And so, you know, became a bit more relaxed. And then I started having conversations with my father about Islam, and, you know, they started to gain a better understanding. And then gradually, you know, I remember the first time when my mum went to the supermarket and she would buy halal meat, you know, so I could start having a halal meat and on a Sunday and meals with the family meals, and it became a lot easier. And I think partly because so many people, so many teachers and scholars I'd spoken to kept on saying, you know, you have to respect your parents, you have to act in this way with your parents, you have to behave like... And they'd seen, I think, you know, my parents had told my brothers since, they said that, you know, they saw a big improvement after I became a Muslim. They saw that I was more willing to help out around the house, and I was more polite with them. Mm-hmm. And actually, whilst Safia and myself went to study in Syria, they actually came out to visit for a week, and so they came to Syria. Even to the point now where, you know, if we're praying, if it's Salat time, they would hear the Adhan, we're in Syria, they would tell us, you know, oh, it's time to pray, you haven't prayed yet. And they would be the ones telling us that you have to pray now. So it became really good. I mean, alhamdulillah, they really like Safia, you know. It gets on very well with my parents. She always makes the effort to call them, to involve them. Even if I forget to call my parents, or Safia is the one who keeps the connection arranged to meet up. So they really... get along very well. You know, my mother and father really do like Sophia, so it's a good relationship. I quite soon, maybe after like 6 months of becoming Muslim, or after a year or something like this, I travelled to Iran, stayed for a month, went to Isfahan, Tehran, to Qom, to Meshed. So that was really a life-changing experience for me, because I got to see for the first time an Islamic community, society, way of life, you know. I got to see a place where majority of people were Muslim, where, you know, there wasn't like bars and nightclubs, where the culture was very much family oriented, where people had a common understanding, you know, of a belief in God, and this sort of held society together. It was very nice. I really, really did enjoy very much. I mean, that was just amazing for me, because I remember, you know, having come from a place where there's no, you know, where we have our local messages, but, you know, you have to drive to get there, and there's a small community, and most people aren't Muslim, and the society is not generally Islamic, you know. To go into a country, to go into the harem of Imam Rida alayhi salam, and it was just, I remember just going there and just thinking, wow, this is the most peaceful place I've ever been. You know, there's thousands, hundreds of thousands of people around. We went there for a Yom Jum'ah, you know, millions, which are absolutely packed. But I remember just thinking that amongst all of this, it's just the most peaceful place I've been to. I just remember feeling like I could stay there forever. I could just stay there in that one place forever. And having, you know, I could sit there imagining, you know, having children and then growing up. I would just love to, you know, I could have just spent my life, because I just felt a peace when I went there. Like, I've never felt a peace anywhere in the world, anywhere I'd been in the world ever, to feel this kind of just tranquility and just a very, very beautiful atmosphere and environment. To get that, to have that sort of honour being able to just come and visit and to pay respects to the Imam alayhi salam, it was real. I felt like very, very honoured to be able to do that. Each place has got a different kind of, like, I remember when I went for Hajj, and the first time I'd seen the Kaaba. And when I walked in and just saw the Kaaba, I remember this massive power, like, felt like overtaking me. And it was that was a very different experience than anything I've ever felt or I've ever experienced since. Because upon just being in the presence of the Kaaba, I just felt like this, I felt all of a sudden so small. I felt like just all of a sudden, and it's the only time I've ever felt like this, where I just felt so tiny and insignificant. I felt such a greater power. When I remember just, you know, literally I just went into Sejda and I just started crying, and for an English guy, you know, we don't really cry very much. We're usually quite sort of, you know, they say stiff upper lip, you know, we don't really cry. And that was a different experience for me, because I just sort of completely broke down into peace. I could just crying. It was just this amazing power which overtook me. That was really a special experience. Sayyidah Zainab alayhi salam again has spent a year in Syria and go and visit very regularly there. And that, you know, this harem has an amazing kind of, because you just have this, you know, Umm al-Masayib, you know, she's this amazing character of this lady who's just been through so much. And you almost feel like you're in the presence of like a mother there, you know, because you feel like she was just, she went through so much challenge, so much trial, and she was always taking care of the people of, you know, the survivors of Karbala. And you just, in that, you know, you really do feel like, you know, in the presence of someone great and someone strong in that sense. There's a lot of media pressure on Muslims now. There's a lot of, it's very, you know, you can't attack someone for being of, you know, like a Jewish religion. You can't attack someone because of their race or their ethnicity. You can't attack someone because of their sexual orientation or their gender. But there's only one which you can now, which is quite openly and allowed, and that you can really criticize people for being Muslim. And every single day in the newspapers, it's become very difficult for Muslims, and on the news channels, constantly under attack. So if I found that, you know, it was too harsh on the children to be constantly living in this environment, or if I found that they were, on the other hand, just getting attracted too much towards an un-Islamic lifestyle, you know, and maybe getting involved in things they shouldn't be involved, then I think that would be a persuading factor, which, despite family and everything, we'd have to move to a Muslim country where there's less kind of temptation for those things.